They've got me doing these drills, with this. They put me in this room that they had kitted out to basically resemble a training ground, where you've got this like wall-sized simulation with a projection, Dar Wars Ambush, which is like a training sniper training game. I'm behind actual sandbags. I've got this modified rifle with CO2 cartridges. So it feels very, they've got a bit of a kick, it feels real. And I'm doing this, and like, this has never been my thing. Like, I'm not a first person shooter kind of person. And I was just sort of losing my mind about like how mad I was about how bad I was at it. And also I was just like, I don't know. And he was like, well, I've got this stuff on you. I've got my, this guy, he'd made his own gel, 3D printed like daisy things. And so I've got this thing like on my back, so I don't know if it's turned on or not, because he was like, let's try to like replicate the conditions of a sham trial as best as we can. We know this is all fairly gonzo and mean scientifically meaningless, but let's just see. And I just, I spent, I, it seemed like I spent 3 weeks just not hitting any targets and just getting blown up by this simulation game. And then when he turned it on, it was really instantaneous. Like, I just suddenly was just calm. And then I was amazing at this game. And then, everything after that seemed very different from how I am as a person, or how I used to be as a person. When I was driving back, I was just very calm. I was a really calm driver. I wasn't like, I'm in traffic, I haven't driven in a year, because I don't drive in London and they drive on the other, so all these yammering little like jerks in my head had just been shut out.
Welcome to Pure Spectrum, where we journey through medicine's overlooked and unexplored corners. Experience what it's like practicing medicine on the International Space Station, operating on an NFL Super Bowl quarterback, treating remote patients in Antarctica, or flying over the burning reactor at Chernobyl. Ride along with a former Navy SEAL physician, embedded with elite Delta Force commandos. Meet renowned physicians, economists, researchers, and journalists, deconstructing subjects as diverse as psychedelics, meditation, science crowdfunding, artificial intelligence, architecture, and more. Join orthopedic surgeon Dr. Keith Mankin, Colin Miller, and our growing tribe as we explore medicine en route.
All right, welcome back. Today, we have science journalist Sally Adee with us to discuss her new book titled We Are Electric, Inside the 200-Year Hunt for Our Body's Bioelectric Code and What the Future Holds. This book and our conversation delve into a fascinating area of biology now known as the electrome. Decrypting this bioelectric code holds incredible promise for understanding ourselves and developing new treatments and interventions ranging from spinal cord injuries to reversing aging. We really enjoyed our conversation with Sally and hope you will as well. With that said, let's get started. Sally, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We were joking before we got started on a good way to start, and we wanted to avoid doing what everyone else does. So there's a very cool story you have to tell. We'll get to that a little bit later. We're going to start. I'm embarrassed to say I actually didn't know about this until you were describing this. This is something called a neural bypass technique that came up recently in the news. And there's apparently a very dramatic video. I'm going to watch it after the podcast here. But tell us about this. This is an interesting starting off point here for our discussion.
So two Swiss researchers, Jocelyn Bloch and Grégoire Coutin, they've been working on this method for restoring movement to patients with a spinal cord injury that leaves them either quadriplegic or paraplegic. And in this case, what they did is what neural bypass means is that you harvest electrical signals from the brain, from the motor cortex, from the whole sort of area that is responsible for sending the intention to move from your brain to, down your spinal cord and to the extremities. And when that's blocked by a spinal injury, obviously they can't get there because the circuits are broken. So what Coutin and Bloch did is they implanted electrodes into the skull and they harvest those signals, and then they send them to a stimulating set of electrodes that are able to activate the remaining axons beyond the spinal injury, thereby like bypassing the injury, as it says on the tin. And they've been working on this for a long time. I believe it was either 2018 or 19 that they and another group in Kentucky showed the potential of this that was so extraordinary that people could move their limbs again of their own effect, And this recent development, this man is able to walk, you know, with a catastrophic spinal injury, and he is able to walk of his own accord. He's not strapped into one of those pulleys with the harness that helps you. He's not, you know, holding on to those sort of rehabilitation bars. I mean, this is like a gait that is improving and improving, which I personally thought that was pretty extraordinary in terms of being able to activate, you know, the sort of motor activity again. I don't believe that's been done before. So
yeah, I'm thinking the long pathway of this. I mean, I don't know how long ago it was some time ago. Christopher Reeves, who played Superman, he was paralyzed after a horse riding accident.
Yes, it was.
And they had a commercial on the Super Bowl where he was walking, and it caused an uproar. You know, people thought, whoa, what did they come up with here? He's walking again. And it was more of a, you know, futuristic look. You know, this is, I can't remember what the commercial was for, but that was a long time ago. And there's been a lot of these kind of false starts. The other problem too is there's a difference between motor pathways and sensory nerves here.
Exactly. So
what's the real challenge with the sensory nervous system and getting that even some sort of feedback? Because it can be something as simple as holding my coffee cup, right? You described this in your book. If I can't feel it, but I can actually, you know, tell my hand to go pick up the coffee mug, I'm going to crush it. I'm going to spill it all over the computer, and that's the end of our podcast.
Yeah, so exactly.
What's been so challenging about that?
Well, it is, I'm pretty sure, having read about sort of the BrainGate program and all these other ones, being able to harvest signals from the brain, especially with these like really amazing next generation signal processing algorithms with the, you know, help of AI, you're able to understand the nature of the signal, and the you know, the machine learning, you know, learns in real time how to decipher your intent. You know, I think a lot of the stuff is quite personalized. And then it's just a matter of basically sort of transplanting those signals from your brain that they already know, and then zapping them into your nerves. And then they can see in real time, does this work or does it not? And then adapt, right? It's like an adaptive, it's iterative. And they're able to show that, you know, this was the same with the BrainGate project, where people were able to move robotic arms to feed themselves grapes. That was the same principle, where you basically had an electrode, an implant that was picking up the correct neuron firing patterns and then translating that into something that made sense to a machine. And then the machine obeyed. Again, iterative process, you had to train the machine. But the problem with sensory is that that gets a bit more slippery. There was an experiment where they had several small Utah arrays, I think it was maybe two, implanted in someone's, in like the sensory area of the cortex. And they were able to, it was an odd experiment. Basically, the man lay there while a researcher pricked the finger pads of a robot, of a robot arm. And they were trying to translate that sensation to the person who was lying there. I'm sort of lost for his name. I believe it's in my book. But basically, like, he was lying there, and so the researcher would prick the fingers of the robot's index finger. And then, I guess through some kind of wild trial and error, they had figured out the electrode placement in his brain so that he perceived the pricking of the fingers as though it was his own fingers being pricked. And this is a longstanding body of research that I think started with DARPA funding as well. Todd Kuchen at Northwestern, I believe, he was doing this like 10 years ago. He had this whole map of innervation for people who had amputations and who had a prosthetic arm. And he was trying to make it so that people could feel with their prosthetic arm. And so what he did is he innervated with remaining nerves from above the arm. He innervated a patch of skin in the chest so that it would create like a little homunculus of the hand, so that when you did this,
yeah,
then the person would feel as though, like, if their finger, their robot finger had been pricked, it was their own finger that had been pricked. This was an amazing body of research. It was super cool. But basically, like,
it's like a user interface in a way, right? It's like using your computer and your mouse instead of coding everything. I mean, that's not the perfect analogy, but.
Well, so basically they've been working on this. It's just that I think it's much more bespoke to try to implant sensory input than it is to actuate motor activity, right? Like, it's so much more personal, and it's so much more, and also, of course, the problem is if you have no feeling in your body, you're going to have to transmit these sensations by way of penetrating electrodes, because that's the only way that you can get precise enough. You can't just put like an EEG cap on a person. I think not even ECOGs could do this, you know, that sort of doily mat that sits on the surface of your brain. So you would have to have a penetrating implant to get close to specific neurons enough so that a person could feel a specific area of their finger or shear force or whatever it is, right? And the problem there is that the implants that we have right now, they don't play that well with the biology of the brain. I mean, they're working on it, and there's a lot of like amazing materials that are in the pipeline. There's a lot of amazing designs that are trying to get past this. There's all this stuff like neuropixels and neural dust, stuff that tries to evade the brain's immune response. But the only thing that is approved to put into a person right now is this Utah array. And that is something that the brain is quite understandably cross about when that gets implanted. And of course, it's got infection risk and all this other stuff. So it's hard to test it in a lot of people, because not a lot of people want to sign up for this. A lot of people who are the research subjects for this line of work, they're people for whom this is either an option of last resort, or they are genuinely like test pilots, like in the Chuck Yeager sense. They are like at the vanguard of, you know, scientific progress, and they know that they are putting themselves at risk, but they're doing it so that, you know, the people after them perhaps will benefit. So, but there's not a lot of people like that. And so the experiments are, you know, in the single digit numbers. And so it's hard to, from that, you know, create something that's going to work for everyone.
Well, you mentioned again and again in your book, it points out how much we know, but how little we really know about the way the brain works, let alone, but really the whole electricity, the body.
Yeah.
And I think the issue with sensory is probably that, you know, motor is an, you know, the muscle is an end organ. So it's fairly straightforward. You zap the muscle, it moves. We know that from the elegant frog studies that you talk about in your book. But we have no idea when a sensory comes up, really how it's processed in the brain. And it's probably unique, as you say, bespoke. So,
yeah, absolutely. And also, like, that brings up also, you know, a lot of the precursor research for this is done in animal models. So for a motor implant, it's pretty easy. All you have to do is sort of zap it, and then the leg moves, or whatever happens, you can see for yourself the result. But it's really hard to ask a mouse or a monkey, like, which, you know, digit they feel the stimulation on. So, and that sort of, you know, this sort of trickles downstream in terms of, if sensory is hard, then like all of these sort of claims about making a memory prosthesis, I mean, that's just, you know, I think that's just pie in the sky, because you can't, you know, how can you figure out the specific, you know, sort of neural, you know, section that encodes, you know, your grandmother's face, you know, I mean, there's a lot of talk in like pop science about like the Jennifer Aniston neuron, but, you know, they're learning more and more, you know, how, I guess, to use like real scientific jargon, how wibbly memory location is, you know? So I think the further you get away from, fairly easy stuff like motor, and I say easy just in the comparative sense, obviously this stuff is wildly complicated, but the more you get away from that, the more careful you have to be about believing.
I don't want to go too far down a rabbit hole, but you
I love rabbit holes, do it.
You use the expression Jennifer Aniston electron, and I think a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with that. Could you expound on that a little bit? Sounds fascinating.
Yeah. So this is this idea that there are specific neurons that hold specific concepts from your memory identity self, I think it's still very much in play. You know, I am not in a position to, you know, as a person who's not a neuroscientist, I'm not in a position to say whether this makes sense or not. But it's the idea that there is a specific neuron that begins to encode familiar concepts, like the grandmother neuron, the Jennifer Aniston neuron, that these things actually can be sort of located in a specific part of the brain. And I guess, to be honest, I've gotten used to thinking of it as something that is not something that I have any truck with. So I'm not really sure about the latest research on it. So it's possible that there's been a paper in the past year that's been like, yes, there is a Jennifer Aniston neuron. So I don't want to, I probably shouldn't opine on something that I haven't recently looked into.
Yeah, and I apologize for So getting back to the neural bypass, one of the things that fascinated me, I mean, the whole thing is incredible. And if we do actually get people walking again, even if they don't have the sensorium, that would be incredible. But the thing that really captivates me is the fact that we are using the brain's own electricity and the body's own electricity instead of applying exogenous electricity. I come from the world of orthopedics, and for probably 2-3 decades, we've been talking about bone healing, but the bone healing has been with these enormous capacitors and batteries that we apply to the leg and then get it to pulse electrical fields. And then somehow magically it's going to heal. And it is, we know that science is okay. But the fact that the science is actually inside the body and can be harvested, which I think is the whole point of your book. Could you talk about that? That, I mean, obviously it is the whole point of the book, but the fact that you know, what's different now is that we are actually looking at getting the electrical signals from the body itself.
Well, actually, so what you're saying, so I think I wasn't clear about harvesting. It's basically like we are doing like decoding what the brain's intent is. And right. Then what we're doing is we are applying external electrical stimulation, like as a copy of what we're getting from the brain. We're not actually sort of able to reroute it. It's basically like it's a cheat, you know, it's like a cheat code. It's like, that's why the term neural bypass. I mean, you know, the fact that we're able to use this very precise stimulation of the nerves to get somebody walking again is phenomenal. But what you're saying, there was actually also something that was trying to get the body's own bioelectric network restored by healing it, by actually interfacing with the body's natural, like endogenous electricity. And that was in the early 2000s. There was a completely different approach to spinal injury recovery. It never got past phase one trials, unfortunately. I get into this a lot more in the book, but it was just an absolutely bananas story about how all these different sort of factors conspired to just like kill this thing in the cradle, including sort of the, you know, financial crisis and, you know, sort of internecine fighting between neuroscientists. But basically, they had this idea that had come to them from the earliest days of studying bioelectricity, which was only made possible after the invention of things like the patch clamp and the vibrating probe in the 1970s. Better electronics allowed us for the first time to see like the, you know, actual electric current coming out of cells, you know, like the fact that, you know, cells had a particular membrane voltage. Before that, it was all conjecture. Basically, people believed that, you know, the signal was bioelectric, and they had good evidence, but they couldn't observe directly. After the 70s, all of that changes. And then people start putting all kinds of cells under electric fields in a Petri dish. And there's this phenomenon called galvanotaxis, where anything you pop in a Petri dish, you apply an electric field, whether it's a fungus or a neuron or a neurite, you know, or, you know, a bacterium. These things physically crawl across the Petri dish toward the cathode of the electric field. And that is really weird. It's quite creepy. They had been observing this since, you know, the 20s, but nobody wanted to deal with it because that's weird. But when they started looking at neurites, frog neurites, lamprey eel neurites, they noticed that you could actually manipulate the direction of growth by changing the orientation of the electric field subtly. Colin McCaig and Ken Robinson were the two researchers who sort of looked into this, and Laura Hinkle, and they actually were able to more or less write their own initials on a petri dish by manipulating the neural growth by sort of taking it in particular directions. This galvanotaxis thing is wild. So this guy called Richard Borgens was like, well, if we can do that, can we coax the severed ends of, you know, the two severed ends in a spinal injury back together again? Because if you did that, you would restore both sensory and motor, because you would just restore all of it. There's this whole thing that happens in a spinal injury. It's not just that there's like a clean severance, you know, it's like there's trauma, you get these big cysts, you get macrophages that, you know, sort of eat too much.
Inflammation's a big problem.
Yes, exactly. And so you've got this sort of no-go zone, and that causes this neural dieback. And if you can get there early enough, you can maybe coax them. The theory went, you can maybe coax them across this sort of no man's land to rejoin. And the way that they did this was this complicated series of sort of pulses. You know, on one end, they would try to, I think the problem was that if you only did the orientation of the field in one direction, the motor neurons would grow, but not the sensory. Sorry, I get into this way more in my book, and now it's been so long, I can't remember the exact details. But basically, what he concluded from this is that there was a specific pattern of oscillation that would allow all the sort of neurons to grow at a specific rate that was faster than the, you know, the opposite growth would. If you're going in one direction, one end is going to go toward you and the other end is going to go away. But they figured out a particular pattern of oscillations that would overcome this. They tried it in lamprey eels. It restored movement. I think the thing that was really like heart-stopping for me was when they tried it in dogs. The stories of this, like that was one of the only times in writing the book that I actually cried while I was writing because they had this experiment. You know, Richard Borgens really loved dogs, and he wanted to try this in dogs, but of course he's not gonna take a perfectly healthy dog and sever its spine in a lab. That's monstrous. And also that wouldn't be useful, because like a clean surgical cut would in no way, you know, recapitulate what would happen in like a messy injury out in the real world. So what he did is he put out a call. He put out a call basically saying, if your dog has had a, you know, catastrophic spinal injury, your vet is probably going to recommend that you euthanize the dog, because even though these little doggy wheelchairs that they have, they look quite cheerful when like a little dog is pulling like a, you know, a little set of wheels behind it. But in reality, the owner has to, manually empty the bowel and the bladder because the dog can't anymore. And so it becomes quite an intensive sort of thing to have the dog. So that's why vets tend to recommend euthanasia. And this is heartbreaking for the family of the dog. So Borgens put out a call for dogs that had these catastrophic injuries, and they would get a little doggy wheelchair, but they would also get this oscillating field stimulator implanted. And it was implanted, I think, for a few months, and then they took it out and they said, listen, don't worry about it. It's free. Just we ask that you return your dog's little wheelchair if everything gets better. And Deb Bonner, who was the administrative director at the lab during the time of these trials, said we got a lot of wheelchairs back. And one of the dogs who had been so worried because he thought he was gonna have to put down his dog. He was one of the people who got the implanted stimulator, and that dog was racing around the stage at the launch of the human trial. So
very cool.
Yeah, it's wild. But anyway, so then they did it. Then they launched a human phase one trial in like 10-ish patients. And one of the things that was really important about the results there, which I probably should have talked about at the beginning when we were talking about the neural bypass, is people who are patient advocates, people who are patients, people who are trial participants, people who have spinal injuries, basically, their number one priority is not often walking, because that's a secondary benefit. They've got a laundry list of things that they would much rather have returned to them than the ability to walk, you know, the ability to have bowel and bladder function, the ability to have sexual function, the ability to just like feel, you know, just being able to feel. So, because, you know, bed sores and, you know, these sorts of pressure injuries are incredibly dangerous for people with spinal injuries, because if you can't feel them, you don't know that you need to move. And then, I mean, that, you know, that sort of feedback is so crucial. And it was Jennifer French, who is a patient advocate for the FDA, who was telling me this. And one of the things, there's a lot of things that torpedoed the oscillating field stimulator, but one of the things that torpedoed it is that at the time, the FDA was very much interested in visible signs, you know, like we were talking about earlier with like the monkeys and the motor stuff. They were like, can the person move their legs? Can they, is this improving the ability to, you know, twitch muscles and like get them on their feet again? And while there were indications that sensation had improved, and that there was, you know, some, the healing seemed to be complex, at the time the FDA was kind of like, well, if he's not moving his leg, then what are we doing? So that was one aspect of a very complicated set of events, a very unfortunate series of events that ended up torpedoing this. But I think there are a number of people who are still trying to get this thing to work, but it works on such a counterintuitive understanding, right? Because it works on the neurons, right? And it works on spinal neurons, but it's not like a neural signal kind of thing. It's not the way that we normally think of bioelectricity, which is, you know, if you ever think of it at all, you think of it in terms of, you know, the nervous system and, you know, passing action potentials. But this kind of electrical interplay has more to do with wound healing than it does with sort of nervous system message passing. And that's a completely different way of thinking of our innate electricity than anybody is really used to.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, massive potential for this. Let's take a step back here.
Yes.
I want to talk about how this relates to the development of fetus, and what we know about this, because it's interesting to me. And it also, we have our third kid on the way, so it's happening yes. right now in the midst of us. So tell us about this, Sally.
Well, so there's been also a lot of work done over the past 20 years to understand how bioelectricity is involved and sort of, bioelectric identity, I guess, is involved in cell fate. So by cell fate, I mean, you know, are you a bone cell? Are you a fat cell? Are you a neuron? What are you going to grow up to be, right? Because everything starts out as a stem cell, ostensibly, or sort of differentiates, you know, from the original sperm and egg. And so once, you know, we did not have the means to be able to investigate any of this for ages and ages. One of the most, I think, consequential tools that they created, Thorvald, oh my God, please delete that. Anyway.
Don't worry. I'm glad you're not asking me to pronounce some of these names. So.
Oh yeah. Anyway, Ken Robinson and this very a Norse person that I think of as looking like Thor. They basically developed this this electric dye, this voltage dye, and so voltage reporter dye. And this is something that basically it turns a voltage from just like an electrical sort of abstract concept into a gradation of light, basically. So you've got like, you know, I think it was high voltages are light and low are dark, or maybe it's the other way around. But essentially you can see with the naked eye what kind of voltage something has. And
it's turning it into data that we can take in, you know, which exactly is what we were talking about earlier.
Exactly. Something that we can observe so that we can prove it to other people, right? Essentially, I'll go back and sort of start again with what the voltage means, right? So most people are familiar with neurons. Neurons have a membrane potential, which means the difference between the extracellular fluid outside and the extracellular fluid inside is something like minus 70 millivolts. So it's 70 millivolts more negative on the inside of the cell. That's because of a whole bunch of little pores called ion channels that move selectively move ions in and out of the cell. And so in a neuron, they really love potassium. They don't like sodium. So their resting potential is minus 70 millivolts as a consequence of all the sorting, right? It's a simple version. But not every cell likes the same ions or concentrations. But they do find that electrical potential changes. Stem cells are close to zero. They're a bit depolarized. There's not much difference. And fat cells are about minus 50. Liver cells about minus 40. Musculoskeletal tissue is about minus 90. It's quite robust. So as an embryo develops, you can actually see, using this voltage reporter dye, you can see these cells differentiate into their different identities. And what's really interesting is that alongside these roles that they're going to take in your body, the voltage of the cell slides up to whatever that is. And they did all these gain of function and loss of function experiments in tadpoles to show that this isn't just an epiphenomenon of something else, right? What they did is when they suppressed the ability of cells to polarize properly, they found that there were some fairly significant birth defects, you know, craniofacial defects in tadpoles, for example, but they could also be rescued by making it possible again, but with the addition of, you know, sort of new ion channels, basically, to rescue these defects so that the body could renormalize itself. So this is a...
What exactly do they do there? So, I mean,
I think it's a
obviously this is not experimentation. We couldn't do this experimentally on a child yet.
No.
But say we're talking about a monkey, or, you know, but we can see there's a birth defect. What are they injecting something into the, you know, past the amniotic barrier?
It's gene therapy, basically. You're sort of doing gene therapy so that you are expressing like a new kind of pump, you know, something different, kind of like they do with optogenetics. You know, they sort of put in like another type of ion.
They could use this dye to visualize a problem early on and intervene this way.
I think that's the dream, right? Like the idea that, you know, maybe once we start to understand what these specific ion channels are that contribute most to like one particular set of cells or whatever it is, then you can start plugging in. I mean, I think that's what Mike Levin is doing. He's sort of the, you know, he's like the Paul Erdos of like bioelectricity. He's like the guy at the center of this like big spoke of researchers connecting all their work. And so he is looking at this bioelectric tissue engine. He's trying to create something that can sort of understand this bioelectric code that the body uses to talk to itself about, you know, its shape and its, what is it? I've been looking for this word for like 2 days. It's basically like it's soundness, you know, like is it like, how does the body know what shape to attain? How does it know when to stop so you don't have one weird long finger or two, you know, like giant bat ears? Like, why is it that, you know, in this, what he calls morphous space, you know, this morphology that you have is always just very recognizably human, or like there's a regulation issue. Chicken, that we all know what a chicken shape looks like. You know, we all know what, you know, an elephant looks like. So like, how does one cell know how to build itself into this particular configuration? And so he thinks that that is, that information is passed by, you know, these sort of, in many ways passed by these particular membrane potentials that organize themselves into particular groupings, like the bone and the skin and the,
all right, so I'm going to take a stab at making analogies here. It's your job, but if we're just building, constructing a building, there's blueprints, but the blueprints don't tell you everything. They tell you some things. But what isn't coming from the blueprints, which is maybe where the eyes go and the ears, that's one builder who's laying down the bricks, telling the plumber, this is where a pipe should go. And they communicate as the building progresses. So it's the builders telling the next steps.
So that's really good, except in the analogy, have it be the bricks and the pipes that are building themselves.
That's true.
Like, that's how weird it is, right? That's, you're just like, you're not sentient, you're a pipe. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, and I think that's, you know, I'm making a joke, but that's really kind of salient, because this whole idea of, you know, the body can't do stuff because it's not sentient, or like, you know, these cells can't do stuff. They're not smart. They're not sentient. They're not intelligent. Like, we've got this like slightly neurochauvinistic attitude where it's just like anything that isn't the nervous system, it's crap, or, you know, it just doesn't know what it's doing. But
we're even researching trees and mushrooms now that there's a communication network that, you know, we're starting to get a better understanding of, you know,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, plants, it's wild. Like, plants have these, have action potentials very much like us, but they don't have a brain. They don't have a nervous system. So what are they doing with action potentials? They've got, in fact, many flavors of action potentials, this variation potential, surface potential. These are reactions to wounding that then turn on this like hormone defense system that can like flood the leaves with enough poison to kill something that's snacking on it sometimes. So there's a lot of intelligence, or what we would call intelligence, but it's super controversial ever to call anything intelligent unless it involves, you know, the human brain to some people. And so, or mammalian brain, animal brain, sorry. So what a lot of these bioelectricity researchers are starting to circle around is that the nervous system is one particular kind of very specialized electrical communication that evolved on top of a sort of underlying pre-existing chassis of electrical communication that we've been using since we were like a freaking bacteria swimming around in the water like a billion years ago. This is like the oldest way, the most conserved communication method. Like, you know, when, as soon as you have a membrane around a cell, you have a difference of electrical potential because, you know, all these ions have different charges. And then as soon as you get little ion channels, then you can start to manipulate your particular ion, you know, content in your cell. And then now you have, you know, an electrical apparatus. Basically, you have a little battery, right? Like at the cell membrane. So every single thing uses this. Every single fungus, bacteria, plant, protist, whatever the heck that is, like reptiles, mammals, like, if it's alive, it's got an ion channel. And it's, I think that is so, I don't know, I just find that so wild. Like, we share this with every living creature. And of course, the reason, this is where I'm going to go a little bit freestyle, but like, this is something I'm looking at right now, because I'm starting to sort of try to figure out my next book, which I think is much more sort of expanded. You know, the thing that's wild is that the reason that we all have this underlying electrical chassis is because we evolved in an electric environment. And that sounds probably weird, so I should probably explain that a little bit, which is to say,
really quick, Sally.
Yeah, sorry.
If we go
sorry,
over a little bit on time, are you okay with that?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. What is it? Yeah, like 15 minutes over, is that correct?
Yeah, can we do that? Are you okay with that,
yeah.
Keith?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Sorry. Continue. I just, there's, sorry, got this here. So there is, lost the piece of paper. I have so many pieces of paper. Anyway, there's a like global potential, which is that, I guess in a really oversimplified, probably very wrong way, you can imagine the Earth as being one of those plasma balls that you see at science museums with like the, you know, yeah, the stuff. So basically the surface of the Earth is negatively charged with respect to the ionosphere. And the way that it gets sort of equalized is by and maintained is by lightning storms. This sounds like probably like the ramblings of an insane person, but like this is like in the Feynman lectures. Like this is like really well established. This is not just like somebody with like red string on a corkboard. Even though honestly, sorry, like every time I tell it to somebody, I feel like I sound like a raving madman. But essentially, like that's the electric environment that we grew up in. To the extent, and it's so profound. There's a difference. It's 100 volts per meter. Like is the differential, like that's how strong like the electric potential is. So, you know, that's a lot. And so basically if you grow up in this electric environment, you know, I think organisms are going to figure out a way to take advantage of it, kind of like we grew up under a sun, and therefore like we evolved eyes because that is something that we are able to make use of. So I mean, this is, you know, this probably sounds a little bit ravey, but I just think it's really significant that we all share this electrical mechanism. And if you want, I can get a little bit more into the way that the body uses it outside of the nervous system.
Yeah, because it's also very lucky too, Sally, because we can study this in animals before we test it on ourselves. I mean, it becomes,
yeah.
Well, that's certainly just the ethical considerations. It becomes enormously more complex when we're talking about our brains versus a lobster, for example. So yeah, it's fortunate that we share a lot of these ion channels and we can study this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So,
not as good for the frogs, as we learned in your book, but you know.
No. I have a theory that like all the frogs that were murdered in the understanding of bioelectricity is part of the reason that this discipline has had such a hard time. But it's the curse of the frogs. Anyway, so the wound current, for example, is one way that the body sort of uses electricity to reestablish its integrity. So when you get a cut, what happens is, you know, skin cells also have all these little ions in them. And when you get a cut, all these, all of them leak out. Everything leaks out along with the blood. You get about a milliampere, microampere of current. And this current generates an electric field. And this electric field is, it functions almost as like a beacon, like a homing beacon, to guide all the cells that need to clean up the mess and rebuild, you know, like keratinocytes, macrophages. You know how I was talking about galvanotaxis before? The fact that all cells will crawl on a petri dish toward the cathode. Well, when you get a cut, the cathode of your self-generated electric field is at the very center of the wound. It's like a big red bullseye. So everybody converges there. And the wound current, the electric field, it starts out strong when you first injured yourself, and then it begins to wane with greater healing as things scar over and everything is less dire. And then by the time everything is scarred over, it's all gone. And one thing that's very interesting is that the wound current in a person over the age of 65 is half of that in people under the age of 25, which tracks pretty well with the fact that, you know I've noticed that my wounds heal a bit more slowly now than they did when I was in my 20s. So I just think that is one way that the body basically uses its electric fields to maintain its integrity, both in formation and to as maintenance over the course of its life.
Well, yeah, that goes back to what Keith touched on earlier. So, you know, in orthopedics, we've used for some time bone growth stimulators. So this isn't as sophisticated as a deep brain stimulator, other things we've touched on, but you're really creating this electromagnetic field around a site where you need a bone fusion from a fracture or spinal fusion that you're trying to create. And they can be implantable, they can be external, but they've had fairly good success with this. And I think what they're trying to do really, I know they're trying to do because work in this world, is recreate what you have as a young child. You know, So as you're older, which is the time when you typically need a spinal fusion, if you need one at all, you don't have the strong, you know, electromagnetic field from that wound that's created during the surgery. So by putting one of these stimulators or overcoming smoking or something else that the patient's doing, you're trying to recover that ability of the body to heal itself that it had when it's younger.
That's really interesting. Do you find that you're having trouble sort of replicating because everybody uses different parameters?
Yeah, it doesn't work with everyone. And it's also the variables are uncertain. So a patient will come in and, you know, I mean, be very clear, right? If most patients, not everyone, but most patients who need major spinal procedures, for example, are older, less healthy, and are probably smoking and drinking and doing other things too. And they're probably not telling you about all of those things that they're doing.
Interesting.
Or they're not committing to, you know, the post-operative care regime that's needed to, you know, to get them back, you know, to mobility. So a lot of things going on there, but it's hard to study because you just, humans are too multivariate and they're too opaque about what they're doing. So,
well, I mean, this
makes
is
sense,
actually...
Keith, you're the surgeon here, but
that's all true. The other problem we ran into quite a bit though, is the desire to make money on it before we really understood the science.
Oh my God. Totally.
Yeah. So, and I saw that many times in your book that we don't have anyone who sat down to figure out what is the perfect pulse field to get that galvanization going. We have this looks really promising. Let's sell it to everybody. And we can then collect the data after we've sold it, but that it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So exactly.
Keith, I wonder if anyone's used that dye, you know, postoperatively to look at what's happening. You know, say in a fracture, you know, repair. I mean, that dye that we talked about earlier would have been interesting.
That would be really interesting. Somebody who's using this right now. They're trying to use it for something for cancer. But if I could put you in touch with her, like, just, you know, I don't know. It's probably not for the podcast, but like she's really
other
good
things
at
that we
using
think
it.
About. Yeah.
But
I'm getting us way off track on that. But that,
no, but actually, it's not, because this, you've actually given the perfect segue for if you wanted to talk about that DARPA experiment, because this is exactly the problem that's plaguing. As
aren't you proud of us for not asking this until the podcast?
Yeah, you made me bring it up.
We didn't even ask. You did it, Sally.
Well, you just gave me the absolutely perfect segue.
A step above NPR here.
But yeah, so this is exactly the problem that TDCS researchers have run into, that people who are trying to use TDCS, not as a research tool to probe sort of neural oscillations, but as a way to actually change functionally those oscillations in order to create behaviors or, you know, change
biohacking
things like, yeah, or change things like anxiety. You know, this is pretty bog standard stuff. They're trying to see if it helps with depression, if it helps with anxiety, fibromyalgia. I mean, the whole nine, like they're trying everything. But one of the issues is exactly what you said, where number one, like the human body is no two heads are the same, right? So when you're applying TDCS, you have to account for everything from sort of thickness of skull, because as you know, bone is a conductor, to how much coffee they had the day before. And then of course, you know, if you're looking at depression, you have to figure out what phenotype of depression they have. You know, do they have the kind that, you know, there's a particular kind that manifests with a lot of like angry little waspy negative buzzy thoughts that sort of seem to originate in like this little part of the cortex that's right over the ear. And if you pop the electrode there, you can shut them up. But, you know, there's so many factors that this is a research tool. And it does have amazing results, just like deep brain stimulation in some people. You know, deep brain stimulation for depression, for some people, it is a miracle, but not for everyone. So clinical trials, maybe sometimes the people are like, oh, that failed. But it's like, there's still like these five people for whom this is life-changing. So you got to keep the deep brain stimulation in. You know, TDCS, slightly less complicated. They don't have to have a big brain implant that needs to be maintained and, you know, watched over. But they still, you know, there are some people for whom it works. But there's so many variables that, like, figuring out a set of protocols and standards is a real challenge.
So the transcranial direct stimulation here we're talking mm-hmm. about. So you experimented on this yourself.
I did. So
quickly take us through this. What sparked your interest in this, and how? I also want to know, how did you get DARPA to agree to this?
That's so
seriously some journalistic skill there. It's amazing.
Well, just I call it my pain in the ass neuron. So it's basically I met the program manager at a big DARPA conference, and for the next 4 years I was after her saying, you have to write me an expert feature. I used to work for IEEE Spectrum, and we had these expert features where we'd get people to basically write it for us because they're experts. You know, they're going to know it a hell of a lot better than a journalist. They don't have to, like, you know, sort of reinvent the wheel and come up to speed with the science every time. So basically, I asked her to write us an expert feature, and she never said no, but she never said yes. So I kept chasing and chasing. And then finally I changed jobs. I ended up at New Scientist, and then I couldn't really do an expert feature anymore because we didn't really do those. So then I called and I said, look, just let me talk to the soldiers, because the results that they had published were, like, amazing. They were able to decrease the time from novice to expert in sharpshooting, I think math skills and some language skills, by a factor of something like 2.3. And, like, that's very significant. That is like that's a real speed up. Yeah. And just by applying, you know, a current to the head. And I thought this was wild. And so I said, let me just talk to some of the guys that you did this to. And they were like, no, that is not our policy, which, you know, in retrospect, of course, that's like, it would be super unethical to, you know, get a soldier on record, like, with some journalist, who knows. Anyway, so it's really good policy. But then I was like, but it was frustrating for me. So I said, like, I'll do it. So they were just like, yeah, no. And then I was like, come on, I'm going to do it. Can you let me do it? And they're just like, well, you'd have to fly out to California. And I'd already booked my ticket by the time he finished his sentence.
Yeah, so, I would have done it too.
So, I was like, I'll sign anything. So I flew out there, and
You could flip it on too. Like, hey, you're going to test this on citizens in uniform, but you're not going to let a journalist try it. Is this something dangerous you're doing to soldiers? I mean, you could, you know, there's all sorts of ways you could spin it.
So, I guess. Yeah. I'm not convinced. I think they've got pretty, I think these days they've got some pretty ironclad ethics rules about.
Okay. You know, very quickly before you continue the story.
Yeah. Sorry. So
DARPA itself, let's take a pause for a second. So
yes,
I think people have heard about DARPA. You know,
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Yeah, they make all the spooky devices that, you know, the
government uses. Well, not spooky,
uses.
Like, you're using it right now. They
well, yeah, like everything from spy tools to GPS. Better body armor, whatever, yes. You know, they're tasked with, right? So, you know, I mean, some people might think about it as the Q from James Bond or something.
Yes, right? So, yeah, totally. You know, yeah, I think that's the version they want to spin too. But they basically invest in high risk, high reward sort of projects, and they have.
It's not just a group of government scientists working internally. They provide grants to outside researchers, right?
Yeah. So they have they hire these people, they're program managers, and they basically say, like, listen, if you want to do something, you have an idea, we will get you for 4 years, and then we will give you a purse, and then you can hire all these people. So, for example, this wound healing project that they have, better bioelectric tissue region. Oh God, I screwed that up. But anyway, it's BETR. It's their program for speeding up, like, catastrophic wound healing using a range of things, including bioelectric parameters, like either to understand the electricity of endogenous wound healing electricity, or to sort of zap them better. You know, there's a whole range of approaches. But basically, they got at least $16 million to, like, just plonk on researchers to pursue this. And it's, you know, it's a multi-center multi-center award. So that means the University of Pittsburgh. I know Mike Levin at Tufts University is working on it. People at the University of California, San Diego. But you know, you've got every, no, San Francisco.
But is it kind of like the NIH where there's a panel that makes these decisions and where it's going? Or is it general?
I think it's a little faster.
The Army needs this and fast. Oh,
I'm not really sure, but I know that like stuff happens very quickly. But like it doesn't, there's and then, but you get your 4 years, and if it doesn't look good, then yoink, you know. And I think I think they have to go anyway, because I know that by the time that I went to the program, they had a new program manager, because they don't want ossification. They don't want somebody to get cozy and just be like, oh yeah, this looks like it might be working. But you know,
then would the federal government own the patents then for whatever is developed if it's something?
I believe the answer is
transferability in the private sector.
I believe the answer is no, but now I don't know, because I think they're trying to speed stuff up. So I don't think they do, because like I remember the first time I reported on DARPA was the Revolutionizing Prosthetics Program, which that was Johns Hopkins creating this like super. The super Luke arm, basically like Luke Skywalker's arm in Star Wars. And I think there are always insurance problems, because like these amazing technological things, obviously you can put them into the world, but like who's going to pay for someone to use it, right? Like it's going to be some kind of, you know, $100,000 arm. You know, is insurance going to cover it? Like how do you? So I think there's like these really awful sort of bureaucratic nightmare problems that, you know, people haven't, they should probably make a DARPA project to fix that.
Fix a DARPA, but, yeah. Okay, I got you way off track. Get back to your story. Sorry, Sally.
No, so basically, so I went out there and I had done everything wrong. I, you know, just like did a sort of red eye flight against, I don't know, it was just a mess. I'd made every bad decision that you possibly make. And I showed up there at 9 a.m. having altitude sickness because I stayed in the mountains and too much coffee. I hadn't slept in a long time. And I was just like, what the hell am I doing? And I was really, really angry with myself and really distracted and really just sort of losing my mind a little bit. And then, you know, they've got me doing these drills, you know, with this, they put me in this room that they had kitted out to basically resemble a training ground, where you've got this like wall size simulation with a projection, Star Wars ambush, which is like a training sniper training game. I'm behind actual sandbags. I've got this modified rifle with CO2 cartridges. So it feels very, you know, they've got a bit of a kick, you know, it feels real. And I'm doing this and like, this has never been my thing. Like I'm not a first person shooter kind of person. And I was just sort of losing my mind about like how mad I was about how bad I was at it. And also I was just like, I don't know. And he was like, well, I've got this stuff on you. This guy, he'd made his own gel. You know, he had made his own electrodes. They were these really beautiful, actually like Art Deco looking things with like, you know, 3D printed like daisy things. And so I've got this thing like on my back. So I don't know if it's turned on or not, because he was like, let's try to like replicate the conditions of a sham trial as best as we can. We know this is all fairly gonzo and scientifically meaningless, but you know, let's just see. And it seemed like I spent 3 weeks just not hitting any targets and just getting blown up by this simulation game. And then when he turned it on, it was really instantaneous. Like I just suddenly was just calm. And then I was amazing at this game. And then, you know, everything after that seemed very different from how I am as a person, or how I used to be as a person. When I was driving back, I was just very calm. I was a really calm driver. I wasn't like, I'm in traffic. I haven't driven in a year because I don't drive in London and they drive on the other, you know. So all these yammering little like jerks in my head had just been shut out. And this sort of,
it was less like a stimulant and more like a suppression of all the other monkey brain stuff that we have going on, right?
Absolutely.
We talked about this in the show, right? That's more what it was. Maybe,
yeah.
Hack towards meditation, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how, when I got back to London, my editor and I talked about it, and I was just like, you know, we settled on this headline, like artificial Zen, because that's what it felt like. It was just like, I had just like done this shortcut to meditation, like advanced meditation. And so I did this thing, and then people were like, oh, I want that. Like, I want to be good at video games, and which, you know, more, you know, that everybody has different, sorry, I'm not judging at all. I'm just saying, like, a lot of people who were most excited about it were excited because that would be like a really good use for them, a good use case for them. And then you started getting all these like sort of backlashy type of things. There was a guy called, I think, Steve Horvath in Australia, who did a meta-analysis of everything that they had been doing with TDCS, which was a lot. And some of the experiments were a bit more responsible than others. You know, some of them were better designed than others. Some of them were real garbage with like no control and like two people, you know. So he basically said, this, all of it is crap. You know, it's all, when you average all of the effects, you get nothing. Then you had another one. He did electrical stimulation, TDCS on a cadaver. And he was like, look, you know, it all sort of dissipates. Not enough gets into the brain in order to affect the way that we think TDCS works, which is the whole if neurons fire together, they wire together thing. And so I started being really paranoid because I thought, oh my God, like, did I just fall for like the oldest placebo effect in the book? And I was like, but it doesn't
inspire thousands of gamers out there to do the same.
I know. And I was really worried about it. And then, but then, you know, at the same time, there were some of the real like OG, you know, TDCS people who were incredibly, you know, rigorous, and they weren't these throw shit at the wall and see if it sticks kind of people, you know. Some of the original, I can't remember his name, but there was a big meta-analysis that they did where they were like, look, we're going to throw out everything that's not a gold standard study. And they found that for depression, for, I think, anxiety, and possibly something less intuitive, like fibromyalgia or something, TDCS was really seemed to have effects, like very significant effects. And so it was never clear. I couldn't really understand. So I set out to write the book because I wanted to understand sort of what was going on with TDCS. Why is it that TDCS gets slagged off, but deep brain stimulation, nobody dares say a bad word against it, even though it's, you know, in both cases, you are applying an electric field to do things to the brain. Like, what, you know, what is going on? Why? And then I was like, oh, there's also vagus nerve stimulation. So I was like, okay. I was set to write this book, sort of like, what do implants do? And like, what does electricity do to the nervous system? And then when I discovered after I had this long conversation with Mike Levin, who told me, you know, bioelectricity is not something the nervous system invented, I started seeing it everywhere. You know, once something becomes legible to you, you're able to suddenly just see it all around you. And I saw all of this work on, you know, regeneration and, you know, cancer, you know, wound healing. There've been a lot of academic books on this, but it's just, they're not legible. You know, people see them and they're just like, either it's bullshit or it's like, you know, something that isn't neuro, so who cares? It's really interesting, like in terms of like the narrative that informs how research is interpreted and done.
Very interesting. And I see the temptation to want to try it. It seems very comparatively less invasive than doing other things, even putting different chemicals into your body. And I don't know, I'm getting older too. You know, we all are. You become more open to taking supplements and other things as you get older, you know, that she didn't care about when you're
yeah, in your 20s.
But
definitely.
So I'm not dismissing these people, but, Sally, in the last few minutes here, I wanted to cover one more thing and then let you go. Thanks for staying a little longer too.
Yeah.
You talked about something I found interesting, and that was the siloing of, you know, academia. We talked about this before on the show, but this is particularly important here because we're mixing physics, we're in electrical engineering, biology, molecular biology, and those disciplines have to interact in some way for any of this to be possible.
Yeah.
And for even to see the potential. And we had Anil Seth on, a neuroscientist in your neck of the woods.
Yeah. Oh, he's amazing.
Year. He is. And he, I think it was the BBC that did it. They did a series where they brought different scientists of different domains and had them go spend time with each other, and they filmed it. And so Anna was one of the people. I watched it before he came on, and I think he paired him with a geologist. I can't remember, but they would go out in the field and then he would go talk, you know, back to a lab with this guy and talk about what they're doing. It was fascinating. And I thought it was a very cool setup, but that's not realistic for you know, a younger neuroscientist who's just struggling to get their dissertation done or, you know, get a position, you know, the Arnold Suffs of the world have already, you know, made it to that point, right? So they can go take time off and do BBC shows and talk to people like us, right? And I was trying to think what other ways, you know, this can be helpful. I think podcasts is one of them. I've listened to other podcasts where scientists are interviewing other scientists. I think that's a great way. But I told you this earlier. I really think science journalists have a role in this. And I love reading your book because one, it was a lot of it was new material for me, but you have a great knack for explaining things in a way that makes sense. And that you also remember. I mean, storytelling is so important and analogies are so important. And, you know, when I think about other science journalists, I read The Economist every week, another publication from your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
They have great science journalists. Very, very good. I can't tell you who they are because, you know, it's The Economist and they don't put their bylines on there. But, you know, whoever they are, they're really good. And I think you have a very important role in what you do. One, for communicating these concepts to the public, but also putting, you know, a cone of focus on one area versus another. I'm curious how you think about that, you know, one as your role and what a science journalist does, but also you have the ability, you know, to put a focus on, you know, transcranial stimulation, direct current, or something else. And that can have an effect on funding and other media attention for scientists and research. Tell us about your role as a science journalist and how you think about that.
So, do you mind if I just push back a bit against this idea that sort of, I guess, individual journalists are ultimately responsible for the quality of science journalism? I mean, I think that sounds maybe a little bit counterintuitive, but I don't want to leave your listeners with the impression that I'm somehow a better science journalist than someone else. I think what I am most saliently is luckier. You know, so as a freelancer, I have the luxury of time to sit around biting my nails about whether I got details of a story right. Do I need to get in touch with somebody again? Do I need to get somebody on the phone? Do I need to sort of deepen my reading around a particular area? I can noodle around a bit like this. And that is absolutely not true of everyone. There are people who have to file like 7 to 10 news stories a day to like an assigning editor who won copy 5 minutes ago. And their employment status depends on being able to feed this beast. And by which I mean the publication machinery, not the editor. The editor is often under the same gun. This is a systemic problem of newsrooms. Newsrooms are being squeezed to death. I mean, we know this, you know, you've read all these stories. You know, when your business model treats everything as content for an insatiable maw, writers are incentivized. I mean, not even incentivized. I would say they're probably like even forced to flatten and simplify and rely on formulas and parrot. And sort of, you know, that's the end of that. The end stage of that is relying on press releases. I mean, there is an alternative. We were talking about The Economist earlier before the show, and they don't have this problem. They throw adequate resources at their people, and that's rare. And you can see for yourself how much better the journalism is. But in the current news environment, that is a luxury. I mean, I guess, you know, if you wanted a really good DARPA program, you know, find a business model for journalism that creates breathing room for reporters to really deliver insight from multiple perspectives on scientific findings. I'd love to run that.
That was the answer I was looking for, because I don't think everyone else feels that way. And some are just journalists who would rather have done something else, but they got put on that, you know, science desk or, you know, whatever, you know, or maybe they'd rather be working at ESPN. Who knows? But, there's definitely differences in the quality out there. And of course, there's a big problem with just, say, press releases being left, you know, released from universities and then just being regurgitated.
Yeah. And the important function that you do too is making the connections that, you know, we may or may not be able to pick up a scientific journal and read an article and say, oh, that's really interesting. But we would never be able to make the connection from that going back to, you know, to Gavani and going forward to what DARPA is doing. You can create these networks. You're your own electron by creating these networks that we can follow to learn. So what you're doing is not just, you know, even if you're just pointing us in the way so we can think ourselves. It's very,
yeah,
very...
yeah, yeah. No, that's actually, that was when I was sort of, you know, at my most desperate points of this book, being like, does this make any sense? Like my, you know, some of the scientists that I was talking to the most, they said that too, because they were just like, look, you know, making these connections will sort of help people understand that the things are connected. You know, for example, Mike Levin, he'll go to, you know, like a neuroscience lab, and he'll say something neuroscience-y and they'll be like, yes, yes, that's correct, correct. And then he'll say something from molecular biology and they'll be like, well, that's just garbage. That's crazy talk. And then he goes to a molecular biology department and he says something molecular biology that the neuroscience guys just freaked out about. And they're like, well, yes, that's, you know, common knowledge. And then he says something neuroscience-y and they're like, well, that's absolute, you know, horse, whatever. And so, you know, there's the siloing, this sort of this concentration of different kinds of knowledge that don't cross-pollinate, you know, that really, like, how, yeah, you can't, like, I think the last time one scientist was able to know all of scientific, you know, everything was like, I don't know. I can't remember. Somebody had this somewhere, and I think it was like 1905 or 1898 or something. Oh, I wish I could remember this better. But, you know, basically, like, you can spend your entire career studying like one gene on a red-eyed fruit fly, and that's, you know, a full robust career. And yes, you know, there's no way for everybody to know everything in science now. So, I mean, I think the journalistic thing is imperfect because journalists aren't scientists. Like, I've not spent time on a lab bench. So, you know, I can get stuff really wrong. I try not to. I try to run it by like loads of eyeballs. But like, you know, I think it's, you know, it's like democracy, the worst way possible, except all the other ones.
If it's that, yeah, but still the best. Yeah.
Interesting book to explore how we got from, you know, the early scientists, the Davy and Volta and Galvani, they were studying everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't know physics was physics. They just thought, you know, these are interesting questions. How does it work or how doesn't? And yeah, sometimes their science was terrible, but at least they were experimenting. And now, as you say, we go to somebody who looks at one little gene on a single fruit fly. Where, how did that happen? That would be a fascinating book. I would read that book. So,
oh, that's, yeah, that is super interesting. And that also dovetailed with the development of jargon, because, you know, when I was reading these old papers, I was like, I can't believe I read this whole paper and I didn't have to, like, you know, blink, basically. Like, they are so, they're so legible. But of course, as the sciences, you know, siloed off, like, and like, they have to have shorthand for all of this body of these different bodies of work. So you get this increase in jargon, which then of course contributes to the siloing problem again, because the guy in geology doesn't understand this, you know, the deep jargon from neuroscience and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, it's, yeah, that would be a really good book.
You know, Keith, there's something close to the book you're talking about. It's so, Sally, I first found out about you, Simon Winchester, who wrote your the book,
yes,
review for the New York Times, right?
Such a nice historian. Review.
He really did a great job, but yeah. I've been reading his work for a long time. My dad loved his work, you know. He mentioned your book in an interview I was listening to. And he's got a book out right now, Knowing What We Know, The Transmission of Knowledge.
That's probably it,
Keith. I think that's what that book is about. That just came out.
That's right. That. Yeah, no, I was about to suggest that for our New Scientist book club. Thank you so much for reminding me. Amazing. All right.
Yeah. I've listened to it for an hour. I think that is what it's about. So that's next on my list too. I got to add that to the pile of books. But Sally, we have kept you way over. Thank you so much for sticking with us a little longer here.
Thank you so much. That was such a good conversation. I really appreciate that.
Thanks. Just remind everybody, so can't see this because we're on video, but We Are Electric, Inside the 200-Year Hunt for Our Body's Bioelectric Code and What the Future Holds by Sally Adee. Great book.
Thank you so much. Oh, I'm really glad you liked it.
Can't recommend it enough.
Congratulations and good luck, and have fun in those first sort of sleep-deprived but amazing
Thanks.
Hours.
Yeah, it's going to be something going back to diapers again. But, you know, we started this podcast. I wasn't even a dad yet, so...
Oh my gosh.
That's just amazing.
Oh, three is a good number, I'm told. So yeah, congratulations. That's wonderful.
I'm told too. It's going to have to be. So we're committed.
Yeah.
But awesome. Sally, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
That was a lot of fun. And we'll put links up to your website and the book on the show notes as we always do. And everyone, wherever, whenever you listen to us, take care. We'll see you here next time.
Thanks for joining us on Peer Spectrum. Please support the show by writing a review on iTunes and join the conversation at peerspectrum.com. Keep up with the latest episodes and share your ideas with us on Twitter, Facebook, or email at peerspectrum.com.